one of the principles that our team has articulated, I think, is there needs to be a little kind of friction in the development of the AIs as they move out into the world, allowing a little bit of time for humans to be able to intervene. A pause, a moment for a human to say, wait a minute, no, that's not real. Or, no, we need to refine the prompt for it to get a better answer, and so on. So I think this interaction between humans with AIs is the way you deal with things like hallucinations.
Welcome to Ask More of AI, the podcast looking at the intersection of AI and business. I'm Clara Shai, CEO of Salesforce AI, and I'm thrilled to be sitting down today with my colleague and internationally renowned futurist, Peter Schwartz. Peter is the Chief Futures Officer of Salesforce and has helped corporations, governments, even Hollywood movies predict the future with uncanny accuracy. Peter, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my delight. It's always a pleasure talking with you, Clara.
I feel the same way. You have to have one of the most interesting jobs, not only at Salesforce, but in the industry. Can you tell people about what you do?
Sure. You're right. It is incredibly interesting, especially at this moment in time, to be honest, you know, because of the dramatic technological change we're going through with AI. My job is to help the leadership of Salesforce make decisions about the future. My title is Chief Future Officer, right? So I work on our big acquisitions. I work on the future of our product. I view on where we go in the world. And then I share a lot of these ideas with our customers. We have a small team that has been around for a number of years that I've worked with. My number two guy, Mick Costigan, has worked with me for over 16 years. I recruited him to Salesforce, and he used to work in my previous company. So what we do is make sure that Salesforce is not shocked by the future, that it actually gets to shape the future, that what we try to do is we try to anticipate where things are going. We try to imagine what are the possibilities out there. And then we try to shape our strategy in such a way that we can take advantage of those opportunities.
Now, you've really made a whole lifetime of predictions. And because before Salesforce, you had a strategic consulting firm. In undergrad, you studied aerospace and aeronautical engineering. You were literally a rocket scientist. How did all of this come about? And when did you realize that you had this ability to predict the future?
But that's a great question. You know, it was my first big mistake about the future, to be honest. I as a kid, I wanted to be an astronaut, and I did get my degree in astronautical engineering. But two things happened right as I graduated. That is that the astronaut market dried up. There was no new space program at that moment. I graduated in 1968, so I'm the oldest guy in Salesforce. And the other thing that happened was that the Vietnam War was winding down. And so there were no jobs in the aerospace industry. So I really got my future wrong to begin with, right? There was very little opportunity for the things I wanted to do. So I tried to figure out what else I wanted to do. And what really turned out was that I was really fascinated by the future. My interest in space and rocket science was really an example of the future that I was really fascinated by. So I began to look for, were there people who actually had a career studying the future? And I found out the answer was yes. And so my real career began when I joined Stanford Research Institute in 1972 in a little group that studied the future funded by the U.S. government. And so that's really how it began, was my first failure as a futurist led to my career as a futurist.
It's fascinating because so many people, you know, the life doesn't pan out the way they expect, but they might not have asked themselves the question of how could I do a better job predicting the future in the future? And you did, and just an incredible story. And you've done so many things. You've consulted with governments. You've worked with a number of large corporations. You've even consulted for some hit movies, including some of my favorites, like Minority Report. You know, what was that like working with Hollywood?
Well, it was, you know, look, I've written a bunch of books, but my movies have had much greater impact. A Minority Report was seen by about a couple of billion people. What actually happened, because I'd worked on a few films before with Spielberg and his producer, Walter Parks. I'd worked on War Games, Sneakers, Deep Impact before Minority Report. And actually, it was Tom Cruise's idea to make Minority Report. He'd read the short story by Philip K. Dick, took it to Spielberg and said, I'd like to make a movie out of this. But the problem was that it was an 8-page short story with no world. There was no context in it. So Stephen came to me and said, listen, I want to create the most realistic movie anybody's ever made about the future. Will you create that future world for me? So I brought together a team of about 15 people, scientists, artists, urban designers, the head of architecture of MIT, Jaron Lanier, a whole bunch of people all on what might happen with the technology and society of the future. And so we spent about 4 days in a hotel in LA with the team, with Spielberg, with the writers, artists, inventing that future that you saw on screen. I wrote it up in what became the Bible, what's known as the Bible for a movie, all the details. And then, look, it helps to have Steven Spielberg put your ideas on screen. Let's be clear, right? You know, so we had a very large budget. We had Spielberg as our director, Tom Cruise as our star. And the truth is, our goal was to, and Steve and I talked about it, that a decade after the film came out, which was early 2000s, that we wanted people to say, why, that's just like in Minority Report when they see the future. And that is exactly what has happened. I think we achieved that goal. Again and again, you read articles. Oh, wasn't that like in Minority Report? And so that was something we felt very good about.
I would say that you succeeded wildly. I mean, it's kind of unbelievable that you were able to imagine that back then. And it makes me think of, you know, we've also recently talked about how, you know, we've got our Einstein trust layer and this need to reduce hallucinations. And that was a concept that you actually had talked about years ago. Can you share that story?
Sure. My first film was a film called War Games, which was actually based on a hack that I did back in 1973 on the ARPANET. And so it was, we came up with this idea of the War Games, a computer that would accidentally nearly start World War III. And that was what the story was all about.
Wow.
Starring Matthew Broderick. And he engages with a computer called Whopper. Never liked that name very much, to be honest. But having said that, the computer then reaches the point where it can't tell the difference between reality and the game. In fact, Matthew Broderick asks, you know, is this a game or is it reality? And the computer says, what's the difference? But then, right near the end, when apparently a large number of Soviet missiles are coming over the pole toward the United States, John Wood, who plays the scientist in the story, points up at the screen and says, don't you realize that's a computer hallucination? And so it was the first effort of AIs to produce a computer hallucination. And we wrote that in 1979.
That's just unbelievable. And that is what they're called. They're hallucinations. And so if I segue now to, you know, how should governments, large organizations, small businesses, how should they harness the power of AI in light of these risks like hallucinations?
Well, look, you know, I think what an important thing to realize is we're still in the very early days. The technology that we are now deploying in a large scale way is really the product of the last few years, and it's evolving very, very fast. We're learning a lot. We're learning a lot. The core developers of some of the technology are learning a lot. The various startups are learning a lot, and our customers are learning a lot. So we're in this period of maximum learning where we've got this amazing new capability, and the capability itself is growing and advancing and becoming more elaborate, you know, as we've moved to multimodality, being able to upload great varieties of all kinds of information to drive the evolution of our AIs. The basic paradigms of the AIs are evolving. And, you know, like one of the issues we have are these giant computer models that, you know, operate, and only a few people can actually produce those. But we're moving toward more smaller models, more refined, more focus driven, more purposeful models. So some of the issues that we've already encountered will begin to go away. The hallucinations issue, I think, is one of the most challenging, and false information. I think that combination of false information and hallucination will be dealt with most directly by human intervention. You know, one of the principles that our team has articulated, I think, is there needs to be a little kind of friction in the development of the AIs as they move out into the world, allowing a little bit of time for humans to be able to intervene. A pause, a moment for a human to say, wait a minute, no, that's not real. Or, no, we need to refine the prompt for it to get a better answer, and so on. So I think this interaction between humans with AIs is the way you deal with things like hallucinations.
And I love this concept of friction. It makes me think of my friend Bob Sutton's book about friction, where for the last 10 years, we've been trying really hard to remove friction from digital experiences, right? So to get people to click on ads and to buy e-commerce. But now you're saying we actually should meaningfully introduce friction to make sure that humans are not falling asleep at the wheel.
Exactly right. Look, you know, before there were risks in speed, right? You wanted things to happen frictionless, as fast and simply as easily as possible. That was the goal. Now, there's a reason for a bit of caution. And that bit of caution is best exercised with a little bit of time. And I'm pretty confident that we'll be able to make that work. As I said, we're in the early days. This is something that I think we'll learn very quickly.
It's just a fascinating time. Well, one of the things I appreciate most from our conversations is how you've helped our team really think about how consumers will behave differently too, not just businesses. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Look, this is one of the great leaps in technology. And, you know, the technology has been in the hands mostly of a relatively few people. Now it's moving out into the world. And, you know, most people have a lot of friction in their lives getting anything done. I mean, I'll give you a concrete and simple example. I was ordering a pair of shorts recently from Patagonia, and I'd ordered some before. And, you know, I went on their website, and it only took me about a half an hour to defeat their website to get my shorts ordered. It was a real pain.
There's too much friction.
Too much friction. So what I really wanted was to be able to say my AI assistant, oh, listen, I want a pair of shorts from Patagonia, like the ones I ordered before, but in blue, not black, and put it on my Amex, not my Visa. Done. That's how it should happen. You know, if I had a human assistant, personal assistant that did all of that, why, that's the way it would work. CEOs have that. Mark Benioff has a human assistant he can turn to and say, you know, get me a pair of shorts. I don't. I want an AI assistant that will help me carry that out. I want an AI assistant to take all the friction out of all of these interactions that are simple and easily done. So I think that's one place where there will be a big impact. Another place, which I'm very excited about, is learning, right? AIs are ideal patient tutors. They have all the information. They can ask you as many questions as you need. They can be infinitely patient, coming back and redoing lessons if needed. So we're in a time where we all need to learn a lot. There's a lot going on, not just in our technology industry, but in society more generally. This is the ideal tool for lifelong learning, whether it is learning how to use Salesforce in our own company, or learning what the issues are in the environment, or dealing with climate change, or in science, inventing new biology. This will be our digital companion, enabling us to be much more capable in every aspect of our lives.
Well, and it's so exciting. I mean, we just launched our Einstein service agents. We're going to have other Einstein agents to follow. And you can just imagine these agents representing the best interests of the brand, the very best brand voice, the very best reps, and then engaging with the consumer's agent. And then in those right moments, the humans, right, being brought in to make final decisions or choose between this color and that style.
Exactly. It's a collaborative process. And that's where we're moving, is the collaboration now between AI agents and human beings in sophisticated ways. As, you know, we showed it in our Salesforce 2030 video, how that might happen in a supply chain issue. So I think that becomes the dominant mode. Look, I have a team of six people that I work with. We will have AI agents as part of our team being able to carry out tasks in our behalf. I mean, a good example is we're producing the second copy of our magazine, the Futures magazine, right? And it happens to be about personal agents. Well, we didn't love our cover the first time. So what we're doing is our agent is actually generating multiple versions of our cover for us to be able to look at. So instead of going off to the art department for 6 days and coming out back with three versions, we get them in 3 nanoseconds. And we can have a debate and a discussion among our team, which of these covers do we like? And so it's that collaboration between AIs that are creative and productive and human beings that make decisions and have good judgments in that context.
I love that you're using agents to teach people about agents.
Exactly.
It's great. Well, given that you have worked on some pretty scary movies, right? There are scary moments in Minority Report and Deep Impact and War Games. How could this all go wrong? And what should leaders be doing? What should we as leaders, government leaders, private sector leaders be doing to ensure that it doesn't?
This is a very important question, obviously, Clara. Let me say what I don't think it will do first. You know, there was this old fear of runaway AIs and, you know, the Terminator, right? AIs that are going to take over the world and kill people. Not a risk. That is not anywhere in the future in the way we're now moving. That was based on an old idea of AI and how it would work. In this world of generative AI, in the world that of AI being created by transformer technology, there's no real intelligence in there. It is just capable of carrying out and simulating intelligence as opposed to being what we think of as real human intelligence. What that means is that the kind of risk of runaway, terrible AI is not real. The real risk is false information, fake information, either deliberately or accidentally created. And I think that is a real risk. And on the other hand, it's a manageable risk. And the obvious way to manage that risk is having human beings in the loop and have transparency in the sourcing of the information. So some of the AIs will show you all the references they used in coming up with the response to your query. You need to actually look at those references. You know, when I read a scientific paper, I actually do look at the footnotes and say, you know, does this guy know what he's talking about?
I think you're special, Peter. I don't think most people do. How can we encourage or even, you know, enforce that?
Well, I'm not sure we can enforce it, but what we do need to do is to educate people. Look, this is a powerful new technology. And just like when you get a car, you need to learn how to drive it. We don't put a car in the hands of a 12-year-old. We wait till they're about 17 or 16, and then we educate them in how to drive a car. We need to learn. We need to learn how to use the AIs. We need to educate people about what the capabilities are and what the risks are, what they need to do to assure that they actually get it right, that they aren't using false information or that they're putting out into the world, even worse, false information for others. So I think that is the most challenging problem we face. It's not, you know, crazy AIs doing terrible things. It is making sure that the information is valid for what we produce. And that is a relatively soluble problem. Now, the truth is, I think the technology is going to evolve so that within a few years, even that will begin to diminish as a real problem.
True. And the education itself, therefore, also needs to be ongoing because
exactly
whatever you learn today will become obsolete very soon.
Yeah, look, again, as I said at the beginning, we're in the early stages of this. So, you know, the honest truth, I'm really quite excited and not really very worried, to be honest. You know, I think the downsides here are relatively modest and the upsides are enormous.
Spear, I was reading your personal story and it's incredible where you and your family have come from. And I'm curious if you'd be willing to share about it and how it's affected your ability to do what you do today?
You know, I was born in a refugee camp of concentration camp survivors. My mother survived Auschwitz. My father was a slave laborer. And when you begin there and then have the life that I have that had enormous opportunities at every stage, whether in education or in my careers or in my communities or even in politics, I feel very fortunate. And I think I feel a kind of sense of obligation, as it were, that is to make use of the privileges that I've been given compared to my parents. You can imagine that the lives they lived were very different from the lives that I've lived. They died relatively young. Concentration camp is not too good for your health. And so having said that, I do feel a profound sense of responsibility, that sense that I've been given enormous opportunities. Society has treated me remarkably well as compared to my parents. So for me, that's the kind of sense that I feel I have an obligation to give back. And fortunately, Salesforce gives me many opportunities to do that, both directly for our customers and for our communities in all the ways in which we work voluntarily. For example, I'm helping the governor of Hawaii as a volunteer project think about the future of Hawaii right now at Mark's request, working with that. And that's one of my current volunteer activities.
Now, we've talked quite a bit about how AI can be used for education. And I just was wondering, you know, what do you think this means for how we should raise kids in the next generation? You know, what advice do you have for today's parents of young children?
You know, the old answer that people used to give is teach them programming. Everybody's going to need programming. Bullshit. Not true. They don't need to learn programming. I mean, if they want to and they're fascinated by it, by all means, they should. What they really need to do is to learn how to work with other people. That is the most important attribute in, I think, modern life is emotional intelligence, the ability to work in a community, the ability to work with other people. And the technology can make that easier, more friction-free, connect you with more people, and so on. But that the goal is really being able to empathize with others, in this case, often with our customers, our fellow colleagues, with our societies, where we take our values very seriously. So from my point of view, it's that sense of human empathy that is the single most important quality to be developed in kids.
Do you think AIs are capable of simulating that empathy?
Absolutely. Look, I mean, one of the great tools of AI is feedback, right? For example, if I wanted, I could have an AI monitoring our conversation and then provide me feedback afterwards. You know, you cut off Clara twice and you weren't paying attention when she said, and you might want to think about the next time when you talk to Clara. You know, I can learn. Kids can learn about how to engage with other people and so on. And I think, again, you don't get a lot of that directly in school. You have to learn it. Well, some people learn it very well and succeed and thrive. Others struggle with that. And so this is an opportunity for improving the learning of human capability.
It is such a pivotal moment, and I'm excited by it.
Well, one thing I wanted to share that I do think is important, that kind of I see because of my history, if I may.
Yes.
You know, as I said, I'm the oldest guy. So I was around when the microchip was born. I started at Stanford Research in 1972, and the microchip came out, the real big microchip, the Intel 8080, came out in 1974. And the important thing that happened as a result was that it was a very generative technology. Vast numbers of new companies were born as a result of the microchip. You went from a world of a few mainframe computers to personal computers, to games, to chips in cars, in toasters and refrigerators and lighting systems and so on. Suddenly, you have an explosion of innovation and startups. Well, we're at a similar moment with AI. It's the first technology since the microchip that is that generative. And not surprisingly, we're literally seeing thousands of startups, billions of dollars of investment, and an enormous variety and variation in the ways in which the technology is developing. And so what that implies is a high rate of progress because there's so many people trying so many things. Lots of surprising innovations coming that we may not foresee very well. I spent a lot of time trying to think that through. But we are in this explosion of innovation that we've only experienced one other time, and that was in the mid-70s. So that's why I'm so optimistic about the possibilities, is that there's so many things being tried all at the same time.
Yeah, it really is a general purpose transformer because it's being applied to so many domains and probably many more that we have yet to discover.
Exactly.
Peter, you've gone through many waves of disruption. What is your best advice for how all of us can thrive in this new AI era?
For me, it's about other people. I can read like everybody else and I get all the periodicals and so on. But my real source of information and insight comes from connections with other people that I think of as interesting and insightful. And I'll give you a concrete example of what can come from that. Many years ago, and I'll tell you how long, it was the late 1980s, in my own company, I was running a workshop for AT&T. And in those days, I tended to bring in interesting people that were surprising. And I brought in a guy named Peter Gabriel, the rock singer, who happens to be a very close friend. And we were in the conversation with the AT&T guys at a workshop, and CDs had just taken off, digital CDs. And one of the AT&T executives asked Peter, you know, now that you can make perfect digital copies of all of your music, how are you going to deal with piracy? And Peter said, well, you know, I can't stop it. So what I've decided is that when I discover that there are pirated CDs selling in, say, Jakarta, I follow it with a concert. I treat it as free advertising. And so it was the new business model of the music industry. He saw it, that it came from live performance rather than selling digital copies. And it was a perfect example. Here was a brilliant musician who also understood technology and society and business, and he brought it together into a remarkable insight that gave us real insight into the future. By the 1990s, that is how you made money in the music business, was live performing as opposed to selling CDs. And I think that's the kind of insight that comes from engaging with people like Peter.
I love that too, because it's really a metaphor for how we can approach these massive waves of disruption. We can either have a scarcity mindset and focus on, you know, loss aversion, or we can completely reimagine what it means to be a singer or a musician or a software engineer and reinvent ourselves and build the future.
Yep. Yep.
Well, what an incredible note to end on. Peter, thank you for everything that you do for Salesforce and for the world. It's great to talk to you.
Well, let me add my thanks to you, Clara. You know, it's a very exciting time to be part of the company with people like you and some of our other leaders who are really making a big difference for our customers and for our societies. So let me say thank you to you as well.
What a fascinating conversation. Three takeaways for me. First, we are on the precipice of an explosion of autonomous agents, both from businesses like Einstein Service Agent, as well as for consumers. Every consumer will have your own assistant doing tasks for you. Number two is that we spent the last 10 years removing friction from all of our digital experiences. Now it's time to start introducing thoughtful points of friction to make sure that the AI has human guardrails and supervision. Number three, in the face of massive change, whether it's war or the advent of the PC or now where we are with AI, there's two approaches, fear or opportunity, and opportunity wins every time. That's all for this week's episode of Ask More of AI. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts and follow me on LinkedIn and X. To learn more about Salesforce and AI, check out our Ask More of AI newsletter on LinkedIn. Thank you so much and see you next time.